name's Katie Leeson and I'm Managing Director of Social Chain UK, and welcome to my podcast, I Shouldn't Say This But. Joining me in this very special episode is Annabelle Mullin. She has had such an interesting career. She's a former police officer, NHS psychologist. She's helped set up political parties and is also a trustee member of a very important charity. Where do I begin with covering what is in this episode? We've got the crazy world of immature politics, being attacked on the ward at Broadmoor, Brexit, immigration, how UKIP might actually have their targeting strategy right, how Amazon might be stealing from the NHS. There's just so much. If you want to know what's going to happen with British politics in the next 18 months, you don't want to go anywhere. So sit back, relax, and enjoy this week's episode of I Shouldn't Say This But. Thank you so much for joining me today, Annabelle. We met in the summer at a conference called Reach. I learned a lot from those 2 days. My big thing is if you can't see it, you can't be it. And I just learned so much from so many amazing women and their stories and their journey, and it helped me in my job and has helped my confidence a lot as well. So I'd love to sort of jump in with your journey, because I know I've talked on my podcast before about how career paths aren't straight ladders and you don't follow that ladder where you go into one company or one profession and stay in it and go right to where you need to and then that's it. And I think your career probably is the best example of it not being that. So I'd love to know about your journey, if that is okay.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's very squiggly, I think. Someone told me that I was a butterfly and that I touched on different things and I took elements with me like a butterfly.
Nice.
So that was quite a nice way of describing it as
that
well.
That is. Mm. Yeah.
Quite fun.
So where did you start out then? Where did your career start?
So long time ago, after I left uni, I actually started at a company called PricewaterhouseCoopers, which is one of the big accountancy firms, and I went in to do oil and gas analysis, and I worked for this internal organisation called WINS, which actually, I mean, it doesn't exist anymore, but it stood for Wallets, Issues, Needs, Solutions, which I thought was the worst acronym literally in the world, until I then ended up going into the police, which was the next place I went. So for about 18 months, I worked in analysis. And then during that time, I was applying to be a police officer in the Met Police in London. And then I joined, got my place.
Ah, what was it that led you into wanting to join the police?
So there's a few things. I think I come from a military background. So my dad was in the army, and there's a real sense of kind of duty and that sort of uniformed service. And I'm kind of a Londoner, kind of born and bred in London, but we moved a lot because my dad's career. But I sort of felt like a need to be based in London and to do something there. And that sense of being part of justice and criminal justice seemed to me quite important. Mm. That's sort of what drew me to it. And the idea, and I love it, kind of early 20s, I want to help the world and, you know, make it better, and sort of naively thinking it's very simple and easy. And so that's kind of how I headed into the police.
What did you do? Where did you start out doing?
And so in those days, you went to Hendon for 4 months for training, which was amazing. It was great fun. We had a team there. They were just brilliant. I was in the purple intake. There were four colours. And then we were all sent to do our probation period out in. So I went to Soho and Mayfair, which is my beat. And I was placed on team one. And they're a good bunch of guys. I'm still in touch with them, actually. And then after that, I did some time with the robbery and burglary squad. I did a little time with the kind of, that's in CID. And then I realised that it probably wasn't where I wanted to spend the rest of my life, because it's not just a job. It's a lifestyle choice. And you either have to accept that, or you basically struggle with it. And I decided that it wasn't what I wanted. And I was also, I thought, at the wrong end of the criminal justice trajectory. I wanted to be stopping people getting into it and not kind of dealing with the end product. And, you know, you get quite tired of constantly dealing with the shit. Mm. You know, you are frontline. And it's quite nice, you know, you very occasionally get letters from people going, thank you so much for helping. But most of the time you get people going, I pay your taxes. What are you doing arresting me? Or whatever it is. And you go, I pay taxes too, amazingly. Thanks very much.
So really you're at someone else's mercy because you want to make a change, but you have to live within the rules that are there and the restrictions that are there, I guess, as a police woman.
And I think I found it really frustrating. I was there at the time that actually in government we had Blair, who was very tough on time and tough on the causes of crime. Fine, I actually don't necessarily disagree with that. But he brought in a lot of laws through what's called statutory instruments, which is a much simpler way to bring in legislation. It doesn't require the same scrutiny. And if you're the front line, you understand how it works on the street. And all these people in the chambers and parliament and, you know, House of Lords didn't seem to understand what it was like to enact the stuff that they're making us do. And you'd be like, guys, how do you not get that this is really difficult to do? And it's so I got really frustrated with that sort of disconnect. And it's still there. I don't think that's changed. You know, and you look at kind of the crime figures and knife crime at the moment, and it's just escalating. And it's so obvious a lot of the issues around why. And it's kind of, you've stripped loads of parts of our justice system bare over the last 10 years. And you've stopped investing in poorer areas and youth clubs and things that stop people getting bored and involved in stuff and poverty and all of the sort of left behind. Mm. It's all part and parcel of why crime happens and why people get involved. So
I'm listening, or I've just finished the Michelle Obama book, actually.
Oh, have you? I haven't read it all of it yet.
Yeah, so I listened to it rather than read it, and she reads it, and it's great, because I'm not very good at reading things in bulk, but she talks about the frustrations that she had with gun crime.
Yeah.
Whilst Barack was in as president, and the resistance to help change anything from a top level in US politics, and you could really feel her frustrations, and it's similar there. She could see it on the streets, and she could see it when she was going in to talk to these kids at grassroots level, but then there was just no willingness to change things at the top because of all the funding and everything else that
and it's inextricably linked there with this sense of I am my own person. You are not allowed to tell me what I can and can't, you know, carry, which is something that we don't have the same cultural identity just because of the way it's been kind of grown up. And so it's how do you create that sort of gap, that space for people to go, I can be me. I don't have to have a gun to be me. Yeah. You know, I mean, from our perspective, the European perspective, it's like, what on earth? Why would you need that to be who you are? But it's sort of interwoven, isn't it?
Yeah.
And that's a really difficult change to make, that sort of, you know, and that's long-term change rather than short-term change, and all politics is short-term.
100%. Basically. See, yeah, she was saying as well that she was talking to a lot of the sort of middle-class, upper-class wives of people in really wealthy women, and they were saying, yeah, it's awful, isn't it? And I don't want my kids to ever go through that, but my husband won't vote to pay any more taxes. And she said that was a real challenge with what needed to change but what wouldn't change from the top. So is it like that here? Is that what we're dealing with?
I think the thing that really struck me when I was a police officer is how you go in and it's the law, it's black and white. And the problem is nothing is black and white. Mm. There are always so many grey areas. And actually that complexity is who we are. Nothing is actually that simple. And however much people want to hear it, there aren't easy answers to a lot of these problems. That doesn't mean there aren't answers. It just means that it's going to take a bit more time and a bit more working together and, you know, a lot more thought than we probably would like. I mean, who wouldn't like an easy answer?
Yeah.
I think a lot of the issues are that you get told something by a politician, which gets them elected because, you know, you have to have a strap line that's three words in order to cut through and to get, you know, any kind of, you know, pick up across any sort of social media. And, you know, if you can get those three words repeated endlessly, people buy into it. And then, of course, actually putting that into practice is much more difficult in the real world.
Yeah.
So it, But there is also, I think there is a sense that political will is really important, and understanding that you can make things happen with political will, but you have to be bold and lead, and you have to be very kind of focused on that end game to get change that you want to get. And that means that you're going to upset some people, and you've got to accept that upsetting people might be the path you have to take in order to get what you think is the best thing. And you have to settle what you think is the best thing and the best way to do it.
Which I think is a great lesson for life, because if you really want something, you have to sometimes upset people in order to get there. And it's feeling comfortable with knowing that you're doing it for the right reasons.
Yeah.
Which is hard, isn't it, when you're trying to be all things to all people and get people to like you and also do a great job. It's there's a life lesson in there as well.
Well, it's the sense of incompatibility, isn't it? You've got to get elected, so you've got to have lots of people vote for you. But at the same time, you want to get certain stuff done. It is not going to be popular necessarily. Mm. Some of the policies that are right, you know, there are things around climate change that I can promise you people are not going to want to hear. But if we want to change how the future looks, we're going to have to make some decisions. Mm. There will be options, but there will be things that have to go. And that's, you know, a hard battle with life, and isn't it?
What sort of things will have to go through for us to make a difference with climate change? We're all told that we should be doing this, this, and this, and then we're making subtle changes, but definitely not enough.
It seems to me that we have to have a conversation around travel. And I don't necessarily mean airplane travel. That, I mean, obviously that's a huge issue. Mm. And advancements and innovation is really important. But actually, 76% of travel in the UK is done by car. You know, 2% is done by train. Mm. People endlessly talk about train travel. Mm. Buses are actually the bigger form of travel. We have to have a way that makes it feasible for people across the country. The infrastructure has to be better. That means end-to-end travel that does not include getting in a car. That's what we have to find a way to provide, you know, and things like HS2, which is a huge, you know, people get very, very upset and emotional about it. But it's 108 billion now we're looking at spending on something that at the moment might only be a slightly quicker link between London and Birmingham. If it's about capacity, that's another thing. But if it's not going to do the other bit, the bit in the north,
Yeah,
that really upsets me, because what's the point if you're not helping the north and infrastructure?
Yeah.
That's what it should be about.
Yeah, 100%. I'm not even going to go into Northern Rail. Because it just, I couldn't even, it's just awful. You have to do it every day, don't you? And it's awful. Yeah, anyway, so you were in the police, and what point was it that you decided, right, this isn't for me? And then did you know what you wanted to get into? And how did you take that leap into something completely different? Because it's scary, isn't it? Leaving something you know and going into something new.
Well, also leaving something, you know, which at that point had a good pension, was a, you know, job for life, was secure. But I think I realised within about a year and a half that the things that I cared about, sort of social justice and finding ways that of helping people, and that I didn't think that being in the police was going to be the answer to that. I think that came, relatively fast. And so then I started to think about the next bits that I wanted to do. And so that was, if I want to be involved with people who have committed crimes or could commit crimes, where can I put myself along the trajectory? And so I thought, well, I'll go and do learn how to do psychology, because that seemed to me a way of starting to understand why people get where they are. Mm. And maybe that at that point I can then help along sort of the path. But as a key worker, I bought a flat in London, and so I had to pay my mortgage. And so I found a job working as a headhunter in the interim period between then being able to afford to do my master's, which I did part-time, whilst I worked in the NHS with those with severe and enduring mental illness who were prisoners. So kind of hated by all elements of society, if I'm honest. Wow. You know, because the community doesn't necessarily want to deal with people who've committed really serious crimes, but also people who have very complex mental illness. And finding a way to get those people back into the community was, and that was really my role, was very difficult.
What did your day-to-day look like then when you were there? How did you approach it?
It was quite interesting. So I was in secure settings. So you basically go from high secure, medium secure, low secure. So Broadmoor is high secure, where people are not really allowed out ever. And then there's medium secure and low secure. So medium secure is where you're very occasionally allowed out, depending on your team and how they look at you. And your team consists of people like me, so assistant psychologists, psychologists, psychiatrists, nurses, and other sort of therapists. And what, you know, we'd walk in one day and we'd be running a session on how to deal with people's fears of, you know, the outside world, or how to deal with a particular person's concern about dealing, meeting with his parents or his family or something along those lines. I basically mainly worked with in male wards, so most of my experience is there. And then you'd spend a lot of time helping people do different things. So one of the guys, and this is probably one of the most interesting stories in a way, was he had come from Broadmoor, so very serious offences, and he had got early onset schizophrenia, drug-induced psychosis. So he'd taken loads of drugs as a late teenager and then got this and committed some offences and then been, you know, imprisoned as a consequence. But he managed to change his diagnosis and actually leave whilst I was working with him, because he had been diagnosed when he first came in, but had been able to show with his behaviour and the work he had done that it was entirely around the drugs and it wasn't a longer term problem. And he actually, seeing him go and lead and move out into the community was an amazing experience, because it's pretty rare that you get somebody to do that, because often it's like a revolving door.
Yeah.
And they get out into the community, they then don't have much to do, mm-hmm. they start to commit crime again, and back in they come. And then you'd have people like, there was one guy, and I can't use his name, but we'll call him Paul for this purposes. He grew up in a home, and he was in a children's home, and he didn't have, his parents kind of came and went from his life, and he committed armed robbery. Now, in prison, there's quite a sort of a moral code for, you know, if you commit certain offences, that's kind of okay. So armed robbery was perceived as kind of okay within the moral code.
Right, okay.
But, yeah, but obviously anything to do with children or women, that was very, you know, that was wrong. So he had this whole thing around his life where he was, my armed robbery was bad, but it wasn't that bad. He was one of those people who I sat with for hours, and we'd talk a lot about his life and his views on the world. And he was a bright guy that, if circumstances had been different, if the world had given him different starting platform, I think he would have been in a very different place. And it was, he was quite an experience for me, because he made me realize how, you know, I'm pretty lucky, but you realize quite how lucky you are to start with what you start with. Mm. And he had no supportive family or environment. He had a mother who came and went and was a drug addict and was an alcoholic and, you know, took him sometimes from his foster care and then got him back. He was abused in foster care. And then he started out, and he was a big man. He started out with gangs in his teenage years. And then, of course, that led to violence. And, you know, and you can just see how these people end up. And he was never going to leave an institution. That was his world. But he had an interesting perspective on dealing with other people, and he wasn't violent when I met him, but it was, yeah, it was extraordinary. And so all of these things that I would never have touched on if I hadn't been in this world. And it was very nice to feel like he was beginning to feel a sense of that there was a community beyond the ward and the institution, because you become very institutionalized. Mm. And then some guys would be like, oh, Annabelle, I don't need to do anything, I'm here on this ward, I get my money for my, you know, disability, I get my sky viewing, why do I need to go anywhere? You know? And so it's sort of that, providing that sense that there is something outside, there is something beyond, and that you can deal with the beyond. You personally have the capacity to cope.
Wow. So really rewarding job.
Yeah, in a way. I mean, it was depressing, because you often felt that these guys weren't going to go anywhere. Mm. But you could find elements within it, I think. And that's definitely my sort of personality, is that I find elements which make me think, yeah, that's amazing. I love that. And, you know, that makes you feel like it's all worthwhile.
Mm. Did it teach you anything else about yourself? And do you think it had a sort of impact on your values?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I think the sense that people should be given a second chance. People given a lot of support and care can achieve an awful lot from different starting points. So I think that it really struck me then. But it was hard. And actually, the reason I left, and I should probably say this because I think it's quite important in a way, was I actually got attacked on the ward by somebody who was really unwell. And he attacked me because he thought I was talking to him, and I wasn't. It was just that he was saying that I was. And one of the other guys intervened and stopped him. And it was only because of the other guy that I wasn't really seriously hurt. And it was this amazing moment where you're protected by somebody you care for, and somebody you're caring for is trying to attack you. Mm. And it was quite an interesting moment. And it made me think I actually probably need to spend some time not on a ward and in a clinical environment, because it was quite stressful. So I think there's lots of things that you take away from that kind of quite intense environment as well.
Mm. Yeah. So then you were there, and then where was your next step after that?
So then I wanted to finish my sort of the curve of learning from the psychology, and to do that you have to go on and do a PhD. And so I started my PhD, but I did a research PhD. So, and actually I'm still finishing it 6-7 years later. So all of my experiences in the police, in the wards, and all of those conversations had led me to think, well, my research, I want to look at the early years and how that affects later behaviour. Because it's so clear to me, every conversation I pretty much had was around my life. I didn't have this, or I did have this and it affected me in this way, or my brother did this and it affected me in this way. Mm. My parent abused me, my parent did, you know. So all of these sorts of things play in to how you become later on. Mm. I don't know, I think Andrew Adonis is quite an interesting example. He's a minister, he's now a lord, ex-minister, and he grew up in a home and has been incredibly successful, having had a very tough start in life, not dissimilar to the guy Paul, who had a very tough start in life, but is in an institution. Lord Adonis in a different kind of institution, but you know, interesting how they've gone and how life has provided different ways for them.
And is that because you're a mum?
Yes.
How does that make you think about motherhood and parenting and raising your children? Do you ever are you more relaxed because of it, or are you quite strict with your boundaries? Like, has it impacted your parenting, would you say?
I think so. I'd love to say I'm probably a better mother as a consequence, but I don't know what I would have been like before without. And I'd love to say I'm more patient than I actually am, because I find I lose my patience quite easily. but I kind of work from the basis of kind of good enough parenting. And any person who works and has kids probably feels immensely guilty. I think you start to feel guilty as soon as you fall pregnant. Oh, I had that glass of wine. I shouldn't have had the glass of wine. Oh, I did X. I ate Y. I went to work and I wasn't with them. I should have been there. You know, all those sorts of things that play out. So you have this sort of permanent sense of guilt. And it's just one of those things, and you have to find a way to balance that and to feel okay with it and sort of comfortable with it.
I talked in a podcast a couple of episodes ago about the gender bind and the fact that women really struggle with being told that you should be a bit of everything, really.
Yeah.
And it's not easy to navigate at all, is it? That guilt feeling that you get. So the PhD you went back into, but then you moved, was it then that you moved into politics?
Yeah, so what happened was I got slowly more and more worried as I could see where the kind of coalition was going, and I could see that the Liberal Democrat, Liberal part of the coalition, which I felt was probably quite a good and important part of a Conservative government, it helped to dampen down. You know, and my viewpoint is we need a strong social framework and a really robust economy. Mm. And those two help each other. And I don't care whether that puts me left or right. I'm not really interested in that. What I think is that those matter more than anything else. And if you don't have the money, you can't finance the stuff that helps people get, you know, on the path and supports people to get to the future. Mm. And so that's how I see it. And I was watching kind of as politics was changing, and I was thinking, this is not going kind of the way I want. And so I became a Liberal Democrat and signed up literally about 3 months before they had the 2015 election, where basically the Liberal Democrats lost 54, 57 seats or something. I mean, they were decimated.
Yeah.
And I was like, wow, I really care about this stuff. you know, and from my experience, I've been at the front line. I've worked in the NHS. I know what it's like. I've been a magistrate. I, you know, I really care about justice and all types of justice. So I thought, you know what, I should stop talking about it and I should get more involved. And so I then became a candidate for the Liberal Democrats and I ran in the snap general election in 2017 for them in Kensington. And we knew we probably wouldn't win in Kensington. It would have been a really big shift. But what we did know is that we could probably take enough votes from the Conservatives to allow Labour to win. So there was a bit of a plan in that even if I didn't win, we knew that we would get an anti-Tory vote in. Mm. And that was quite exciting. And we did, only by 20 votes, longest count in history.
Wow.
It was two nights we were there and it was amazing. And so there was sort of a, I mean, it would have been great if it had been me. But it was good that there was change because, you know what? People needed change. People need to see and feel that change can happen because, you know, you have these safe seats, which I never, ever experienced, somebody new or different. But during that period, I was already pretty disenchanted with the Liberal Democrats. I think internally you realise that these parties are, they're 20th century parties, political parties. They're not professional. They don't work in ways that I think you should be working. I mean, whether you look at anti-Semitism or Islamophobia, different, you know, the internal systems are archaic. You wouldn't have this in a modern business environment. You would never have some of the things that people say or a reporter say. I mean, there's a new Conservative MP at the moment who set up a sugar daddy's website. He was paying people in Thailand £2.49 to work for him. I mean, the whole thing is utterly unbelievable. And it's surreal that this man is representing us in Parliament. And the standards that I have in my professional work would never be allowed to be. And so sort of having kind of perceived all of this in the political parties, and 4 days after the election in 2017, Grenfell happened.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'd been there, my team had been on the ground, we knew people there. At 4 a.m. the WhatsApp starts buzzing and says there's a fire, and we all, you know, pile down to help and trying to do something to help. And that it felt for 3 or 4 days before City of London came in to take control, it felt that there was a complete absence of leadership at local, regional, national level. Mm-hmm. And that absence was filled by the community. And, you know, I'm still in touch with a lot of the people who helped during that period. And it was at that point that you turn around and you think, we've got this. We've got this better than the political parties have got this. Why do we have to have these guys tell us how to do it? Mm. We can do this better.
Yeah.
And I still firmly believe that, although trying to cut through is a bit harder than I had hoped. So then I set up this political party called Advance, and we ran in the local elections in 2018, only in Kensington and Chelsea, because we basically wanted to change the makeup of Kensington and Chelsea Council, because we didn't think they deserved to keep their seats after what had happened with Grenfell. And actually, we managed to get 17 Conservatives deselected, so they weren't allowed to stand again as Conservative councillors. And some of them have been in for 50 years. And that's the kind of, you don't have this turnover, this, you know, there's like this democratic deficit, and that you don't get new people engaged in it because, you know, only 2% of the population belong to political parties.
Yeah.
And we actually need far more people to be engaged and be active to make a different, you know, type of political party.
Why do you think that is? Why do you think people?
Because it sucks.
It.
I mean, you spend hours standing on doors talking to people who don't want to talk to you, or trying to cut through. You have to, you know, you give up loads of time to volunteer for something that whereas you could go and work for a charity or in your voluntary time, or you could do all these sorts of other things. And so it's much easier, and it's because it's become, you know, the sort of two-party system dominates.
So you started a political party, which is a bold move.
It was funny because at the time it seemed like, it didn't seem so bold. It seemed like just the right thing to do.
Yeah.
And I did it with Simon Kellner, who used to be the editor of The Independent. And he's a great guy, and we're good friends. And we both felt that there was a moment where we could try and just do something a bit differently. And it, you know, it was great because we got new people to stand who'd never been involved politically before. Really an amazing team. And whilst none of them got elected, I think they felt that they're being able to have their voice and playing their part and being active within their community in a different way than they'd been already was really big. I mean, it was quite interesting because consequently, you know, I've written references for a couple of the guys doing different things, which they would never have felt confident enough to do if they hadn't done this. And so it's opened up other options and opportunities as well. So it's quite interesting. But I do, you know, I think it's a bit like when Jess Phillips resigned from the leadership race, the Labour leadership race last week. And I just wanted her to know, thank you for playing your part.
Yeah,
it doesn't matter that you haven't won. Mm. You've played your part. And actually, particularly as a woman, that's so important in this environment. You know, to you know, actually say, I'm here, I'm going to stand up and try and, you know, run for what I believe in.
Yeah, it's quite reassuring to see the Labour leadership race that there's so many women standing.
It's exciting.
I know. Yeah. I know. I'm kind of watching it from the sidelines. But politics is such a tricky topic to navigate, I think, yeah. And feel like you can talk knowledgeably on, because you get so many different opinions and... the news is always so negative and it's hard. So I would love some help. If you can help me. And because Dodds and I have tried to cover a little bit of politics before. We're not experts. So we'd love to understand a little bit of what's going on from someone who knows it from the inside.
Yeah, I mean, it's a bit of a minefield, isn't it? And also, you know, it's slightly, I mean, my position is slightly odd because I don't sit with either of the main political parties, which I suppose is more useful for this. Mm. But I also, you know, I was an advocate to remain in the European Union because I thought it was the best position for our country. So that's slightly aligned where I am. And obviously, the result has not gone the way I'd want, but we are where we are. And I think it's really important to get behind this. And now, you know, there'll be opportunities. There's also a point where we will spend the next few years at a minimum doing EU trade negotiations and the transition period and what we, you know, need to get out of it. So we need to be constantly kind of critiquing and looking closely and holding to account the government on what the next steps are, because we don't want to lose a lot of the rights, the citizens' rights, the working rights that we have that are really important to who we are as a country. Mm. You know, I think you know, I love Britain and what it stands for, and I love the United Kingdom and the sense that we as culturally always look after our most vulnerable. And I think at the moment we're not actually. And I think that's a real shame because I think it's something that we all feel quite passionately about. So, but yeah, I think we're looking at Conservatives the next 10 to 15 years as a government. I don't think there's going to be any challenge to that. And there's lots of reasons why. First past the post makes it almost impossible to cut through. I think Labour's internal conflicts are going to carry on for some time. And, you know, Keir Starmer looks like he's going to win it at the moment. I would love it to be Lisa Nandy because I think having a female who's strong and passionate and anyone who can hold Andrew Neil to account on a programme is good in my view.
Yeah.
But she also, she's talking some really good, you know, sensible policies and she speaks with, you know, a sound voice. Although I wonder if she'll reach out to the urban voters in the same way. Mm. But anyway, I think Labour are going to spend the next 5 years navel gazing, basically, and organising themselves. I think the opportunity comes if we can work together. The sort of anti-Tory, as it were, organisations can work together to produce an effective opposition, because that's the thing that really strikes me. In a two-party system, you need to be holding the government to account.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you just have to. That's how it works. And if you're not, they then often run roughshod over the things that matter. So, yeah, that's sort of my fears at the moment. And I think a lot of the stuff that I worry about, the sort of the big picture things are done on an international level, whether that's about taxing the big digital companies, whether that's about climate change, whether it's about the AI. Those are international level agreements. And we are becoming more nationalist in our perspective. Mm. You know, we're coming out of the European Union. I think the United Kingdom is looking at becoming not the United Kingdom very soon. And I'm a unionist, so I feel very strongly about that. And I wonder actually where nation states are heading. Like, are they going to have a place in the future? Or is it all, you know, massive corporations, massive organisations? what does that mean for how the nation state lives? I mean, my community might be, I might have more in common with someone who lives in Paris than somebody who lives in some of the rural areas of England.
Mm.
That's a weird dynamic.
Yeah, it is.
What does that mean for the future and how we all, you know, are? Does that mean that England becomes less of England to me? I don't know.
Yeah.
You know?
It's fascinating, isn't it? Some really changing times.
Yeah. Some big things to answer, I think.
I wanted to touch on something that you said there about anti-Tory. So something that I noticed during the election was the volume of conversation on social from a lot of the people within our office, young people, who were very vocal about the fact that they were going to vote for Labour and Jeremy Corbyn because they just didn't want anything to do with the Tory government and Boris Johnson. But then the result obviously was a completely different to what was being said on social.
Yeah.
And I also wanted to touch on social media as a topic because we've discussed this before. And the fact that political parties are using social to put out messages that sometimes don't always fall in the line of truth to try and get an answer that they want. And I know this is an area that you're really interested in as well, and I'd love to hear your opinion on it.
We did quite a lot of work in the... So I basically worked cross-party in the general election, supporting candidates from kind of... As long as they were the anti-Tory candidate, we would be supporting them. And we worked in marginal seats, so about 76 seats we were working in and putting out stuff. And a lot of our ads we put out were, you know, some of them were borderline... Yeah, I mean, we pushed all the boundaries, let's say. We worked within the limits of what we're allowed to do, but we pushed it to the extent. And that's absolutely right. Regulation in this area is ridiculous. I mean, you know, Zuckerberg himself said, you can lie if you're a political party. You're completely carte blanche to lie. And, you know, we saw that with the Conservatives, who were quite clear that it was... six hospitals, actually it's 40. No, it's not. It's really six. And okay, you know, I mean, there is always going to be this uncomfortable dynamic with what you hope can be possible and achievable, because we all hope for lots of big things. And there is that sort of element of propaganda, which is never going to go away. I think we have to be realistic about that. But there is also just an out and out lie. Mm. And, you know, advertising and marketing, you would never allowed to be allowed to say some of the things that they got away with saying. And why can't we have that kind of regulatory environment around political parties? You know, you have to say that you're a political party, you have to register how much you spend, you have to do all of this stuff. Why not have the same thing in terms of a kind of advertising marketing standards agency for political parties, you know?
Because we are held to such tight accounts when we're doing adverts. Like, you cannot step a foot out of line, and it just seems like there's a completely different rule for some of the most important decisions. So advertising makes you buy products, whereas this is like our future and our lives, and they can basically say what they want.
I know. I mean, I think the thing that's also quite interesting around the whole political dynamic is it's a real relative game. So you get a lot of people saying that they're going to vote for Labour and that sort of thing, but it's a relative game in the sense that it is relative against the person. And Corbyn's manifesto might have been, you know, interesting and exciting, but it was unbelievable. People didn't think that there was substance to it. And I think that's the point that people forget. It's not like a Nike shoe. It's not like, I'm going to get this Nike shoe, it's relative to another thing. It's like, it's Nike shoe, or you might go an Adidas, or you might do this, or whatever, whatever. But it's, you know, you have a kind of brand, and you choose that, and you might stick with it. But here it was like, it's either Boris, who you might not like, or it's Corbyn, who you actively dislike. Mm. That's the relative game.
Mm.
Or it's Jo Swinson, who basically has run a presidential campaign and nobody believed that she could actually be prime minister. Why would you do that? Yeah, I mean, the messaging around that was just hilarious. Yeah. I was like, what? It was the worst campaign I've ever seen. In fact, I was, there's this great Facebook advertising library, and I track it all the time to track what kind of different political parties and the third entities like Best for Britain and various other organisations and Vote Leave and whatever are putting out there. And there's some pretty outrageous stuff on that as well. I mean, there were some organisations who were running pretending to be the Green Party and telling people to vote Green in certain areas to help split the vote. I know. It's amazing, isn't it? I mean, and they were actually saying that they were the Green Party, which
technically it's only the Green Party gets affected by that because it affects their spend, but it's not actually illegal. Mm. You know, it's amazing.
Shocking.
Yeah, but that you can do this sort of stuff, you know?
Sort it out, Zooks.
Yeah, I know. So, we did actually. There was a report put in on Monday this week to try and create the environment for changing it. But unless there's political will, and I don't think there is very much to regulate around this area at the moment,
it kind of benefits them a little bit, doesn't it? If they can say what they want, so it's going to be tricky.
Yeah, and there doesn't seem to be, you know, Facebook itself doesn't seem to have any impetus to change it. Although it's interesting for them, it's not their biggest, it's not a very large amount of advertising revenue, and it's quite a lot of bother.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously in the States, it's a lot more advertising revenue, but it is an awful lot of pain for not much gain. Mm. And you sort of wonder why they continue to do it. And why didn't they just do what Twitter did and just ban all political advertising? And, you know, but then that would affect small parties like mine, which actually the only way you can actually have a say is it's so cheap to do it on social media.
Yeah.
Whereas you can't do it, you know, otherwise.
And then you can't stop people, for example, in the US, like Trump, who can just do it off their own platform anyway. Yeah, yeah. So it's like you can, it's difficult to control, but there should be something in terms of regulating the lies 100%.
Yeah.
And that kind of leads me on to my next question, because I am politically homeless. I don't know where I sit, and I've swap and change with who I vote for, and it's tricky to see through the, it's just the lies that you get sent. How do you, what advice do you give to people when they're, I suppose retrospectively, because we've done the election, but what advice would you have given to someone when they were trying to choose who to vote for and to look?
I think what's always really interesting about this is, and people don't necessarily see it, is that your local MP is actually who you're voting for. And people don't think about it like that. In a general election, they think about they're voting for a prime minister. Mm-hmm. They don't think about the person that they're voting actually on the local level, which actually is who you're technically voting for and who is your representative. And they get sort of this groundswell. I mean, I think, you know, and with some of my work, I work across with Tory MPs. And so, you know, you have to choose where your values sit, I think, and where you believe fundamentally they're going to be. I mean, a lot of people were really worried about Corbyn because they felt that it was going to open up this whole sort of, I don't know, high tax environment, and just it felt really sort of scary. And so relatively, Boris seemed okay. But actually, if you're voting for your local MP, is that person a good representative for you? I mean, it is amazing to think there's a new Tory MP in a Welsh community, first time ever. And she got in with about 12,500 votes. The next was a Labour with 12,000. There are some parts of London where, you know, like Luciana Bergen, who I know really well, you know, she got more than double that and still couldn't win. Yeah, it's amazing that the way the sort of the system works, you know, and we are with the first past the post, that is a big issue for anyone trying to break through. But what's interesting is we've got May elections this year, and they're local elections, and lots of people can run. And in fact, we're starting a new organisation called Run for Something, which is non-partisan, and it's just supporting new people, independents who want to run. We'll support, you know, anyone who shows a sort of inclination towards progressive politics and trying to advance the country. And the idea is just supporting people to get, you know, to have their say and to be their voice. You know, last year, 350 council seats weren't even contested because people couldn't be bothered. And that's such a sad thing.
So we have to start local.
Yeah, in a way, and actually, I mean, it's the UKIP model. It's actually what UKIP did.
Ah.
Which is, I mean, I know that makes people feel a bit uncomfortable, but it's true. And actually, it's quite a good base from which to sort of work. And it means that you can also have, you know, you're embedded in your local community, which is just an extension of your home and is so important.
Yeah.
You know, to all of us, how that feels and how that is. You know, that is a way to really feel locally very active. Mm. And you actually start to see that you have an effect, which I think is quite nice and tangible.
Yeah. Nice. Mm. That's a great tip. So I'm going to move on to hot topics, if that's all right. For each of these topics, I'd just like an answer. If you could have your way, where have we gone wrong, where have we gone right, and what needs to happen in the future? So immigration.
As a proponent of freedom of movement, I think we have gone really badly wrong in resource allocation. So what I mean by that is it's such a major issue how we support communities when they have a lot of new people influx into them. And that means, you know, GP surgeries are under-resourced. That means schools have been under-resourced. And people feel that, you know, that stretch. It's a bit like too little butter over too much bread. You know, they feel that impacts them. Whereas, you know, like London, which often is dominated by immigration consistently, doesn't feel quite so much because it's had some quite well-tailored resourcing put into areas. I mean, it has huge pockets of severe poverty as well. But so immigration is a problem only because we haven't thought as carefully through it as we needed to done and put stuff in the right way. We've also not used the rules that existed, which I find really frustrating. Mm. As a magistrate, I've, you know, been in court with lots of overstayers and people who have basically fallen off the radar, and we spend a very long time trying to get them out of the country. We also haven't fined companies who employ people less than minimum wage and under the radar. You know, all of those things have an impact on immigration and why people overstay and why people, you know, and then that has an impact on resources. And I think also the other regulation that I found frustrating with freedom of movement, after 4 months, if somebody doesn't have a job, they do not have to stay here. That was always a piece, but we never really enacted it. And so I think a lot of people felt really strongly that, you know, that these people were staying and not playing their part. And I don't think that's wrong. I don't think of immigration though as being a bad thing. I think it's really important. And as an island, we are made up of immigrants.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, it'll be interesting what happens now, because of course, you know, we're going to change our immigration policy, and there's some really important fundamentals there. You know, somebody who's never earned very much money because of being, you know, always in the public sector pretty much, you know, a 30 grand cap on stuff, well, that wouldn't get you a psychologist in the NHS. That wouldn't get you a police officer. That wouldn't get you, you know. And there are lots of these areas where we need people. So it needs to be really carefully thought through what we're going to do.
It links back up a little bit to what you were saying before about how your start in life.
Yeah.
Because I think a lot with immigration, we see the problems but not the reasons why someone would want to leave their country.
Yes.
And we're also lucky that we were born in a place that we have had what we needed.
Yeah.
And that's my take on it. It's more like the human side, I guess. It's like we're lucky to have what we have because of how we started out, similar to what you were saying about the
we are, but we're not doing it evenly, and that's the problem, right?
Yeah.
So we get loads of kids are leaving school without being able to read properly. Well, that's just wrong. You know, that is a fundamental. Everyone should leave school being able to read.
Yeah, that's crazy.
You know, I mean, that is just, it's mad that we've allowed that to become a thing. And that's consistently we fail in the you know, the ratings against other countries in that. And there's a really strong correlation between you know, inability to read, dyslexia, and criminal propensity. So maybe, you know, there are lots of things that we can do to help
make a difference and change the overall.
Exactly.
Next top topic, the NHS.
Oh, the NHS. I mean, I love it. You know, having worked in it, it's great. But I don't think we're having an honest conversation about it. I don't think we're saying, what do we actually need? What do we want? How can we actually feasibly fund it in the future? There are lots of different funding models. Germany and France have some interesting ways of doing it. I also think we don't spend enough on preventative medicine and preventative. And we've got so much resource within the NHS in terms of data and understanding how we can prevent things getting worse and how we can do better. And I think the focus needs to shift from the kind of reactive, you know, I will deal with the illness at this level, to the I will stop it happening in the beginning. That is where I would like to see the shift, because I think that's really important. But I find it really worrying that Matt Hancock has recently made a deal with Amazon where they basically get to service the, you know, the phone calls when people phone in, and Amazon take all the data, and it's for free. They didn't have to pay for it. And it's like, this is valuable. Data is essential to everything now. It's the fabric of all of what we're playing with. You know, you see that in all of your research, right? Yeah. So all of this stuff, and you know, there is value in that NHS data. Let's make use of it.
Yeah.
Let's make some money for the NHS from it.
That's crazy.
I know. It's like, ah.
ready. Brexit.
I'm sad because I think it's closed some doors for us. I mean, I'm sure others will open and we'll definitely see them, but it just still seems an odd choice to go, you know, this market literally on your doorstep and to go, do you know what, we're not going to have that interaction with this market, we're going to make it more complex, which is basically what it does. And I, you know, I understand the sovereignty, but I think of myself as you know, yeah, strongly British, English, European. None of those don't work. I can have all of those feelings and feel proud of all of those different elements. And it doesn't seem to affect me being part of the European Union. So I never really understood the sovereignty piece because, you know, I can shout for England when they're playing in the rugby and I can be irritated by Scotland when they're playing and beating us and, you know, all of those elements. But at the same time, I can be proud of being the United Kingdom. So, yeah, it's funny, isn't it? But I think there's lots of things that we need to just make sure don't lose out. You know, EU migrants living in this country have made their home and their lives here, and they now feel a great deal of uncertainty about what it means. And I think providing them with safety and security and feeling that they do belong and that they are wanted is a really important piece of the picture. You know.
Interesting times ahead.
I know.
And my final favourite one, immature political party behaviour.
Yeah. One of the big things I found really frustrating, so I spent a lot of time last year trying to negotiate sort of joint platforms in which I wanted parties to work together on. So Change UK and the Lib Dems sat in rooms trying to negotiate them standing on for the European elections on a joint platform. And Change UK sort of going, we are the new party, we're going to take over, and laughing instead of saying, I don't think you've understood. You're talking about a party with, you know, years, decades, and 130,000 members, and you think you're somehow going to, yes, you have a brand that's quite cool, but you need to understand that these platforms and none of you work better without being in, you know, these coalitions. It actually is the way to do it. Our electoral, you know, I mean, the Conservatives are effectively a covert coalition, as are Labour. If you want to beat that, you have to become a coalition, covert or not. Anyway, I wasn't successful, and it was a deeply frustrating year to go from one lot to another. And you're like, this is immature political politics. It really is, you know. And then none of them are fit for 21st century. I mean, their internal regulations, the way that Labour have dealt with or haven't dealt with any anti-Semitism, the way the Conservatives are dismissed as Islamophobia, the way that people get away with doing things that you'd never, in your company, there's absolutely no chance. The language people use, I mean, it's amazing that they think it's okay. And it's because it's not professional and they've come from volunteering and they felt that that's a different landscape. You just set the same parameters as you would in a professional environment for the volunteer environment. It's not actually that hard, but you do have to actually create this framework that means people feel supported. And, you know, in the 21st century, that means having people who've got kids and allowing them to work different hours and all of those things that make for diversity in an interesting workplace.
You know? I want you to go in and change it all. Yeah. Go in and start the change. So I want to spend some time talking about the amazing work that you're doing in helping raise awareness of something that's very rarely talked about, and the topic of child trafficking. And I'd love you to tell me a bit more about what you're doing in that area.
Yeah, well, I was really lucky. So one of the guys that I've been doing some political stuff with came to me sort of last year and said, Annabelle, I am supportive of this charity called ECPAC. And I was like, oh, I don't know much about it. He's like, well, it deals with child trafficking. It's been very much at the on the lead on sort of the modern slavery legislation and trying to stop these things happening. And it's very involved in advocacy and campaigning. And I think it might be something that you'd be interested in looking at. And I met the CEO and we talked around what they were doing and how they work to protect, you know, the children who come here, who then become, you know, young adults, and often they have travelled thousands of miles in incredibly difficult circumstances. I mean, you know, you hear stories of crossing deserts and walking across deserts with nothing, with no family, no support, nothing, and they end up here, no documentation, no support. I mean, they have less than nothing, and it's the way that ECPAC is created is designed around helping these kids deal with the trauma, the experience, and then helping them to lead a life. And these young adults really want to give back to the country that they now call home. And often they can't because they're not documented yet. It can take 7-8 years to get documented.
Wow.
You know, they can't even do apprenticeships in that time. They can't often do anything. And it's finding a way to create a different, you know, version so that actually they can be part of and you know, doing stuff, which they want to do. And we want them to be part of the fabric. And, you know, so it's you know, being involved in that. And I was asked to be a trustee of the organization, so sit on the board. And we have basically just brought in a new CEO who starts in a few months, and in the meantime we've just brought in an interim CEO to help us kind of establish, sort of get various stuff in place for the new CEO coming in, who's got a very exciting idea about the strategy and the future. Because our youth group have been leading the charge. They're amazing. They have all been trafficked. And they are the organization which was used to sort of advocate for them. We're now trying to make it so that they are the advocates for their future and for the future of this organization. So there's lots of things kind of going on. Yeah, they're extraordinary. I mean, you know, there aren't many people that you meet in life and you think, this is amazing that you have lived through this experience and you have come out to be so strong and so proud. And they love being British.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they love being part of our country, which I think is also quite a testament to us as a country. But we'd like to make it easier. Mm-hmm. We'd like them to have stable futures and to have a home that they can call their own and to be able to give back in a way, you know?
Wow. So you're now, as you say, a trustee. What does that entail? What do you do?
So we're not kind of operational, although apart from when you're, you know, bringing on a new CEO for the organisation, you're really there to kind of advise and to make sure that the values of the organisation are looked after and, you know, and cared for, and that the sort of strategic direction is something that you think fits within why, you know. And ECPAC's been around for 25 years. It's the leader in its field for this kind of work. And, you know, it's got a very strong vein of advocacy and campaigning. And that's really important to it as an organisation. And obviously, you know, we work across party. And so Theresa May was a big proponent of the Modern Slavery Act. And, you know, there's other people who feel very strongly. Caroline Lucas from the Green Party has been working on some of the stuff as well. So it's really nice that there's this place where people can come together across from different places, and what they're trying to do is help kids of the future, you know, who've had nothing, actually. You know, it does make you quite proud to be involved.
Yeah,
really.
I bet it does. And I know you've been lobbying for new laws to be brought in to stop these sort of crimes, and you've had amazing support from companies like The Body Shop and celebrities, yes, like Martine McCutcheon, for example. What are the sort of success stories that you can share that you've had so far?
Well, I think what's really cool is that a couple of days ago, there was a petition of 260,000 people to demand that a young man who was trafficked here as a child, that he can remain in this country, and the support that he had. So that was delivered to Number 10 a couple of days ago. Then we've also got the Stable Futures Program, which is about asking the government to support giving them a platform and documentation to allow them to stay in the interim whilst they then get full documentation and allow them to be fully participant in society. And alongside that, you know, whether that's about mentoring, there's also a guardianship program that we're now looking to put in place so that the kids and the young adults have guardians who, when they arrive in this country, often they don't have one person who they can see. They'll have a social worker here and a social worker there, and they might move and change, and they might have foster parents. But it's the idea of giving them somebody who's stable and consistent throughout their life. And I think a lot of people would gain from that, as kind of, you know, both the guardians and the youth. So that's on one of our next big projects.
Wow.
Yeah, it's exciting.
What can we be doing more of? What needs to happen in, say, the next 18 months to help prevent these horrible crimes?
I mean, it's such a complex area because a lot of it is criminal gangs, international criminal gangs. I mean, there's money laundering involved in why these kids end up where they do. Sometimes they end up in the UK and it's just a platform to take them to somewhere else. So there's a lot of things that can be done through ECPAT, who, you know, if you go on the website, which is ecpat.org.uk, and then you can sign up there for to learn, you know, where you can help with petitions, where you can help with donations, where you can help with just getting out communications about it, learning where you can sign up to support and volunteer. We have volunteer programs where people come and help the young people come and help organize various different things, you know, and obviously there's sponsorship, all of those sorts of things. The guardianship program is in its infancy, and we're interested in people's ideas and thoughts on how they might be able to help. You know, we love lawyers who like to get involved and help us in that way. People who are interested in being foster carers. I mean, that's a really important piece. I've met some amazing foster carers. One who told me the story, and this is the most unreal thing. When you come here and you've been trafficked, the government likes to ask for proof. And one of those tests is what's called a scar assessment. So if you've been tortured, they assess your scars. And I was trying to describe this to my seven-year-old because I couldn't believe that we do this, but we do. So they get you, they take your clothes off, and they assess your scars. And the idea, you know, I said to my son, imagine somebody takes off your top and they're looking at your scars and they're assessing the scale and the type of your scars. Because if you've been tortured, it puts you in a different category. And it's such a traumatic experience. And the idea that we have a scar assessment is something that we do. And he couldn't, you know, I was trying, the seven-year-old going, but mommy, does that mean that, you know, would they measure the scar? What this means? Mm. And he was really interested in the kind of, you know, the gritty details of it. And I think actually, if people knew more about what it means, because for these people, they go through, he's young, they go through this trauma of getting here, and then they have the trauma of proving that they've been through that trauma. And so there's lots of things that they need, you know. So we have psychotherapists and psychologists helping them get over that trauma, and then often the re-trauma of having to prove that they're scars were scars. I was really moved by that. That was one of the things that really struck me, because I couldn't believe that we had scar assessments. Mm. Like, that was a thing.
If you can just tell everyone who's listening the website again of how they can get involved, because I'm sure after listening to that, there'll be loads of people who want to look up a bit more information and how to volunteer.
That would be great. There's tons. So it's ecpat.org.uk, and ECPAT is ECPAT. And we've got Facebook and Twitter and Instagram, and we're looking to do podcasts with the youth group. And so we're looking to do lots of things, and we need lots of support to make it possible. Actually,
I want to say thank you so much for sharing your incredible journey that you've been on. So much, so much, and so much that I've learned from that. And I'm now definitely going to start thinking about politics from a grassroots and from my home level, and stop thinking about the bigger picture. Soon. Yeah, I know. Back to my childhood. But no, thank you so much for your time.
Oh, thank you very much for having me. It's great.